Hey everybody, Ron Brinkman here with VFX show number 10. And I am joined today by Mike Seymour of FXGuy.com, FX PhD, and various and other sundried things that keep him busy. Hey Mike.
Hey Ron, how are you?
Doing well. And again, John Labrie, who, what title did I make up for you last time?
I can't recall. I'm having sort of website online program envy. I suppose I need to put something together and make myself a more legitimate person in the world. Let's just say, yeah. I'm like an FX, you know, aficionado.
Yeah, good. Independent visual effects infrastructure consultant.
Okay.
Yeah. And again, Mr. Lindsay is not with us. He's off in the wilds of Africa still. I think he's scheduled to be back again next week, although I may be gone. So it's hard to get all of us in the same room at the same time, even though we don't actually end up in the same room or anywhere close to it, since Mike's still down under, and I'm still in Southern California, and John's actually in one of the flyover states, as we were saying.
I'm in Boise, Idaho right now. It's coming up on 7:10 p.m. It's a really hot day and lovely out, really.
And that's just a hotbed of visual effects activity there, right?
Absolutely. No, I'm relaxing. I'm getting away from my life.
Very good. That's a wise idea.
I might actually be with you next week. You might be in Amsterdam, right?
Yeah, I'm heading over to Amsterdam for the IBC conference, which, for those of you that don't know, is a conference that's mostly broadcast video, sort of generally, but there's a pretty strong visual effects and graphics kind of component to it, similar to the NAB show here, I guess, is the most equivalent sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, I'll be hanging out there. Any of our European listeners happen to be over there, then pop on by.
Yeah, IBC is a good show. John Montgomery, my business partner in FX Guide, is going over. He always covers IBC, mainly, I think, because Amsterdam's so close to Paris, and let's face it, there's so much interesting stuff to do when you get to, you know, after the week after IBC, if that makes sense.
There's a few interesting things to do in Amsterdam as well, but we won't.
I was going to leave those alone.
Too many details there. But, well, that's good. So you guys have something on FX Guide talking about the show, you think?
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to be covering both stuff beforehand, and we've got a podcast coming out next week with one of the new players that are entering the field in VFX, and then we're going to have some stuff from Amsterdam from John.
Very good.
And we actually also have people from the FX PhD training site that are also going. Gary, from one of our professors, as we call him, is also going, and he'll be doing stuff from there as well. So both sites are covering it.
Good. Yeah, it's always a fun show. I think it's you know, some of the new stuff gets announced there. Supposedly the RED camera, which I think is interesting to a lot of us that deal with the visual effects.
Well, now RED is actually going to be showing the first of their 4K images.
Yes,
they're actually going to show a camera. They're not going to like show a metal frame and a plaque that you can buy.
See, now, John, you are just going to feel so bad. If these guys make their deadlines and make their schedules, you're just going to be so bad that you know, I have friends, not close friends, but I have friends in the RED team, and they've never broken NDAs, but they keep on smiling and saying things are going well. And yes, they're showing 4K. Well, it's actually almost closer to 5K images using the new Sony 4K projector at IBC.
Right.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing it. So.
Well, I have to admit, if you look at the brochure and you look at the price point, that's a pretty extraordinary piece of equipment. But I haven't actually seen one yet. So.
No, absolutely. And the proof is in the pudding. But two things. Firstly, if you're going to enter the market, the only sensible price point to enter is at a lower level, because then you'd sell a lot. Because there just isn't that much demand for, you know, I mean, like, we just shot with the Genesis camera for FX PhD in Queensland. So we did this great miniature shoot. We shot with Genesis, and I love that camera to death. But when you take into account the Arri, the Genesis, and the Viper, I mean, how many more high-end digital cameras? If you made a new one right now, you're not going to sell more than, what, 50 tops? I mean, you know.
For a camera like that, people don't tend to buy it. They tend to rent it anyway.
But if you came out with a camera at $17,000 that's doing 4K, you're going to sell hundreds of the suckers. Yep. I mean, you're just going to, like... So it's really a case of, if you were going to enter the market, the only sensible place to do it is at a lower point. And just, you know, any DOP and anyone who's in VFX is just going to end up buying one just to have it. Yeah, that's my opinion.
I agree. if it's 17K, I'll buy one.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, that's without lenses, of course.
But if it lives up, you know, anywhere even close to what they're shooting for, then yeah, it is one of those sort of change the paradigm kind of things. So I'm very curious to see the pictures.
And yeah, but I mean, you know, as I said, let's find out what the images look like at IBC and see how the guys are going.
Yeah, yep. I was going to say that we could try to do a podcast from IBC, but I don't think we're going to be able to actually see a movie in Amsterdam, right? I mean, unless we schedule something up before we leave town, I don't know if I'm going to have anything else underneath my belt to check out.
Yeah, I'm not sure either, but we can kind of play that one by ear, either that or Alex can figure one out while we're
right,
out.
Right.
I don't know. Or maybe we'll do a quickie from the show floor, live from Amsterdam.
Right.
More or less.
So, film you saw on the plane on the way over.
That's right. There you go.
Review.
And speaking of planes,
I'm reviewing the effects in a movie that I saw on a 12-inch screen or an 8-inch screen. What are we doing today, Ron?
Let's talk about some mother effing snakes on mother effing planes.
Wow.
I hope everybody appreciates the effort we go to for these shows and the occasional pain we go through to bring high quality research to everybody out there. So we're seeing snakes. We're talking about snakes on a plane, and John, I know you had some strong opinions about it. So let's just talk about the movie itself first before we get into the.
It seems like I always get to talk about the movie first. So let's let Mike talk about snakes on a plane and what he thought of the movie.
So I guess there's two aspects of this film, right? There is the context of it, and there's the film itself. Like, what would you judge this film by if you just walked in off the street and knew nothing about it and saw it? And then the context of it being hailed as, you know, the most internet-led marketing campaign in history to raise the profile of a film without spending a gazillion dollars. So I say that to the just watching the film on its own, it was a 70s/early 80s disaster horror film in the classic genre, and it had all of the stuff that would appeal to a 12-year-old boy, possibly even as old as 15 or 16. and to that extent, if I'd walked in off the street and just seen it, I'd have been like, okay, it's kind of lame, but I really like Samuel L. Jackson. But having said that, I went with a completely different point of view. I went with I thought this was going to be a hoot, and I was, you know, had popcorn ready to throw up the screen. And the people I went with, we were all like, we basically sat there and tried to guess from the moment we saw a character which ones were going to die, and then kept a scorecard to see how accurate we were. And I have to say, we were pretty accurate as to who bought it by the end of the flight.
Yeah, I agree. I think you pretty much nailed it. It's with all the hype that it got. I mean, the interesting thing to me was that the critics that reviewed it, whether they went into it thinking it was just going to be terrible or something, I actually heard some okay reviews on it. People saying, well, you know, it's kind of fun. It's got a lot of energy, but I wouldn't even go that far. I'm all for campy movies that don't take themselves too seriously. You know, give me a Army of Darkness any day. That's great. But you got to be a little bit inventive, a little bit clever, and everything just seemed so obvious. Like you said, you could pretty much line up the scorecards and know what they were going to do and the beats they were going to hit. So I was not impressed.
You know, it's the ultimate high concept film, but it's pretty sad when the title of the film is really a concise and accurate plot summary.
Mm-hmm.
And there isn't much going. There isn't much more going on.
Plot summary, yeah.
Exactly. I mean, it's very linear progression. I'm with you guys. I love, you know, popcorn film. You know, check out for 2 hours. Check your brain at the door. I totally buy into that stuff. And I like Sam Jackson too. And there's some stuff in here that's, you know, fun to watch and kind of funny. But mostly it's in terms of filmmaking, it's a bit of a train wreck, and that's too bad. I mean, it, with a little bit more thought and a little bit more time, it could have been a little bit more interesting, and that might have, you know, pushed it into the, you know, the cult classic or, you know, guilty pleasure category, and it just doesn't really land there for me.
Yeah,
it certainly was wider the mark on guilty pleasure.
Disappointed by the box office as well. It didn't really do any kind of interesting numbers. It did the numbers that are equivalent for what a movie like that would tend to do, I guess. Although, I don't know. Maybe if you look at it, the 15 million or so that it did is probably better than it deserved. So,
right.
Maybe the internet marketing was successful.
I mean, that's the attitude I take. I mean, I wouldn't have gone to see it. I don't think we'd be reviewing it had they not done such a great job with, you know.
That's true.
Setting it up.
That is probably true. I would have just not even considered going to see it. But it wasn't, you know, for me, it wasn't the. It was not really the internet buzz that made me go see it. I mean, part of it, of course, because we needed something to review this week. But, you know, we decided what to go see. And for me, it was, like I said, the critics that had, you know, several critics that said, you know, it's actually kind of fun. It's not the disaster that you'd think from the title and whatever. But I don't know where they were really coming from. Cause
I didn't want to get up and walk out. It wasn't like just so objectionable that I just, you know, there goes an hour and a half of my life I'll never get back. But
yeah, that was my
I guess the thing is for me, and I come from a country that has pretty proudly most of, you know, the highest. I think we've got like 9 of the 10 world's most venomous snakes, right? and the thing is, the premise of a pheromone-induced lay of flowers causing snakes to suddenly become incredibly active in an otherwise very cold environment of a cargo hold. I mean, it was just such a leap of faith from this outset. These were like snakes on a mission. These had a, you know, I was almost expecting them to be possessed by aliens.
And overplayed. If I had to see that shot of the snake having sex with the lei one more time, I was going to throw something at the screen. It was I know I saw it at least 3 times, and maybe 4. It's like, just to remind us, that's right, the snakes are after the leis.
and not a particularly good shot either, I'll say.
Yeah, no, not great. No. All right, well, what do you guys think of the effects?
Yeah, let's talk about that, since that's ostensibly why
we're here. That's the interesting thing, isn't it? Because they actually made the film effectively and went and showed it to, I think it was New Line, who then went, hey, this is kind of fun. Let's go back and shoot some more stuff and let's add more snakes. So, in fact, there was a period where they went back and not to fix the film, but just to get an R rating and add more effects, they just shot a whole bunch more, and they would go through shot by shot and say, can we add another snake to this shot? You know, somebody falls here. Can we just put one on the edge of frame here? And they just sort of peppered the film with another whole second batch of snakes after the first lot. And one has to wonder whether the Jaws school of unseen menace is more threatening hadn't occurred to somebody.
Yeah, well, there certainly wasn't much in there. I mean, there were a couple of scenes where you maybe jumped a little bit, but...
Yeah, subtlety wasn't the long suit of this movie.
No, that is
true. When you've got snakes biting people in the eyes and snakes attached to people's penises, it's they're basically trying very, and they were doing that stuff early on. They weren't building up to it. It was like, let's just throw everything at the screen and see what sticks, so to speak.
Yeah,
that's definitely the case. Actually, I should give a shout out to VFX World, who has a really good story about the penis shot. If I could recount it, because I think if you haven't heard it, it's pretty darn funny. They, for those of you that haven't seen the film, I think you've already gathered what happens. But the way that they were going to show this at one stage was just to have a snake coming out of a pair of trousers for a guy in the men's room. And then they decided, no, it'd be much more interesting if it was slightly, and the word slightly underlined, more graphical than that. And so they decided that they needed to get a prosthetic made. And the trouble was, they didn't really have time to get a prosthetic made. And so under the category of all-time greatest requests of a VFX supervisor, the supervisor had to go to a... now, what would you describe them as in America, guys?
Either a sex
porn
shop
or a sex shop.
An adult there you go. Toy store.
This store, the VFX about to walk in and said, look, I'm making a movie and I need this this male member, but how can I put this? In a relaxed position, and thinking that this would be impossible to get, right? Because, like, you know, I mean, I'd never been in one of these shops, but I'm sure that I would imagine if I was asked to do this that I'd be thinking the same thing, that wouldn't be a common request. But unbeknownst to certainly me and from all accounts, the VFX supervisor, the guy was like, oh, yeah, no problem. Opens up a huge cabinet full of these things in that particular position, and they just picked the right color, shape, and size, and then stitched a snake onto the end of it, and that was what was used in the film with the guy holding the other end of it. And you just got to give marks for a VFX suit that's willing to do that.
It's high concept filmmaking.
That might have been a better film. I mean, the imagined film would be might have been a better film than this one.
So I do have to say, you know, as much as we're ripping into the movie, I actually thought overall the level of effects was pretty good. It wasn't flawless, but you know, I was actually, and some of this is because we haven't really had too many movies where we could dive in and rip the effects to shreds, and I was kind of hoping that maybe we'd get one of those here. But actually, overall, I think the effects were reasonably well executed in most cases. Certainly, most of the effects sort of were of snakes, obviously. And there were places where it didn't quite work, and you know, some of the movements, I think partially due to the fact that they probably wanted these snakes moving more quickly than snakes normally would move, didn't quite.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it, with VFX, when you get asked to do something that in of itself is not realistic, but it's wanted to be achieved in a fully realistic fashion. And it's I mean, we get that a lot, not just to pick on these guys, right? But I mean, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. There's plenty of times where you're asked to break the laws of physics or whatnot to get something that the director feels.
Yeah, to make something that reads. Yeah, to make something that reads in the screen. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I thought quickly. There was no animation that really bugged me. I mean, obviously there were points where the snakes were, jumping in your face or doing things that a snake won't really do, or they felt like a little bit like, you know, snakes that were almost like little dogs.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, I thought the animation of the snakes was pretty decent. I thought the texturing of the snakes was pretty decent. There was, you know, it was, they were a little bit maybe shiny and hard in a couple of spots, but it didn't bug me. Shadows bugged me. The integration of the snakes into the environment a few times leapt out to me and said, it's not quite there. Really.
Yeah, there were places where I saw, you know, it looked like a very nominal kind of, okay, put a drop shadow underneath it kind of thing, and it didn't, you know, it felt like it was purely composited shadow that wasn't even necessarily rendered. It was just sort of dropped in kind of thing. I agree that the textures overall look pretty good, although there's a couple places where you see close-ups of what I'm sure were real snakes, and there's that sort of iridescence that you get on
that's what I was going to ask you guys about, because there was one shot early on. I can't really give you a very good description of it because it sounds like every other shot, but there was a shot of a snake under a seat. And it curved, so its curve was towards us about a third away across to the left, and head was moving away from us. And it had a really nice iridescent, almost a rainbowing happening on the
way. And I think that's the shot I was thinking of too, but I am...
Now, is that real or fake? Because that's nice.
I think that was a real one, and that's why I kind of mentioned it. I know exactly the shot you're thinking about, because that's the one I was thinking of too. It's sort of a bluish-purplish kind of sheen on it.
But if somebody did that digitally, I want that guy who does shaders.
I would be willing to bet, and somebody may prove me wrong here, but I'd be willing to bet that was one of the real snakes, because it had exactly that characteristic of the little more iridescence that you get off of a real snake, and I didn't see that same sort of shader detail in most of the other snakes that you saw. And that particular shot was one where it certainly could have been, you know, there was not a lot of acting, if you will, from the snakes going on in that shot, which is another reason why I could easily believe that was a real shot.
Hmm. You could do that, right? I mean, that sort of iridescent sort of look, I mean, if you're willing to spend a little bit more processing time, it wasn't the, I can't recall the name of the renderer that was used in Superman to do a lot of that sort of over-the-top iridescent, you know, work in the ice and stuff. You might be able to use it for that kind of lighting, yeah?
Yeah, I think you could, but I'm just guessing they didn't, because I didn't really see it in a lot of the other snakes.
Right.
Had they written a shader that gives that kind of thing, you'd probably use it more than they did.
Sure.
Well, it's Cafe FX and Hybrid, right? And they were using mainly Mayer and Soft Image, mm-hmm. but I don't know what actual renderers they were using.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, put it this way, if that was a digital shot, then whoa, you know, full marks. Mm-hmm. If it wasn't a digital shot, well, then they had a really good example of what to go for.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that was nice.
And certainly a movie like this is not, you know, that, you know, they weren't throwing that much money at the effects and that much time at it. So, you know, knowing that going in, and, you know, overall, like I said, there wasn't a whole lot of stuff that really bugged me in there.
There
was a shot that I think is a perfect example of mismatched black levels, which I'm now obligated to point out, apparently. But there's a scene closer to the end where a very, very big snake starts to wrap itself around one of the characters you've grown to hate, so you know he's going to die. And it's, you know, it's some kind of a constrictor.
The headshot?
What's that?
The headshot?
Yeah, the one where the constrictor wraps around him and then eventually starts to eat him by the top of his head on down. And there's definitely, if you look at that, it's a classic example of where the live-action stuff of him sort of arms pinned, the overall, the black levels of his body, and particularly his hands as they're kind of moving around, they're fairly elevated. It's not at all deep blacks. And then the snake that's laid on top of that, composited in, it goes darker. It's noticeably darker than the blacks of the snake are noticeably blacker than on the live action plate, and that's exactly the kind of stuff that I'm talking about whenever I say mismatched black levels. So keep an eye out for that one for those of you that haven't seen it, and in spite of what we're saying, still plan to.
Yeah, interestingly, one of the houses I think was using Inferno for compositing, the other one was using Fusion. So, but hey, I've got something I want to ask you guys, and I'm sure I'm right in this. Do you know when the snake expert, the FBI agent, goes to find a snake expert, got nothing to do with the plane? Mm-hmm. There's a shot driving to this guy's house,
the
guy walking out of the house and getting in the van and driving back, that mm-hmm. I swear somebody shot on mini DV and up-rezzed. I mean, maybe not mini DV, but it looked like I could see video artifacts, 30 to 24.
There was some strobing going on there. I was thinking that it was probably from retiming, where they maybe just decided that they wanted the van to take the corner. But the one I noticed on particularly is the van kind of turns a corner. And yeah, it felt kind of stroby. It felt like it was sort of stuttering along. And yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe it was a pull-up, pull-down, whatever, from 30 to 24, or it may have been sort of a retimed shot that didn't have the best retiming algorithm being used. But yeah, absolutely noticed that as well.
It, that really stood out to me. It's like, what the heck's going on? It was several shots, right?
It popped to me too. And I know a couple other guys that saw it. It said the same thing. It said, I'm not really sure what was happening there, but.
Yeah, so I don't know. And which I guess, you know, if it really, I mean, it was on several shots, so maybe retiming doesn't make as much sense, you know, in terms of they wanted to retime it purely for speed, so maybe it was something that was shot at a different frame rate, and then
While the retiming logically doesn't sound right, it actually visually sort of lined up, because there was definitely frames there that were clean, clean, blur, mm-hmm. clean, clean, and so that would obviously be more like a retiming artifact, but done in a kind of less than optical flow kind of.
Well, I'll take the couple of seconds to just sort of describe for people the you know, when you retime something, I mean, there's a few different methods for doing it, and kind of the classic method before some of the newer technology became available was using, you know, frame blending. So if you want to make up intermediate frames, you would blend between two, you know, frames side by side, and you know, you could use that, for instance, to slow things down by making up the intermediate frames. And the same thing happens in the other direction, where if you want to speed something up, you generally can't get away with just dropping frames, because you know, especially if it's not a totally linear speed up, or if it's not a nice whole multiple, like you want it to go twice as fast, so you drop every other frame, you end up having to make the intermediate frames up again. And if you're just using frame blending, then you have you know, sometimes you hit the original frame and it's very sharp and crisp, and other times you hit something that's a retime blended frame that's a blend of a couple of frames, and it ends up looking softer and sort of mushed together. More recently, in the last several years, there's gotten to be some very good tools, either available as native tools or as plugins for some of these packages, that use what's called optical flow, which does a much more sophisticated analysis of the image, of all the motion of all the pixels in the image, and then it effectively does a little mini localized warp to make up those intermediate frames. And you know, if your optical flow algorithm isn't quite hitting it right, or if you're not even using it at all and you're just using frame blending, then I think that's the kind of artifacts that we were guessing that we were seeing, something that was a retiming that wasn't using something terribly sophisticated.
Well, as they were night shots, it's quite possible they shot on something like a 750 or a 900, just to get a better response curve in the black, so they could, if it was a second unit kind of pickup shot and they shot at HD, mm-hmm. maybe they were shooting it, I don't know, but it'd be interesting to see if it ever comes out. But yeah, it's interesting that both of you guys totally stood out to you, because I was like, knocked me back.
And then somebody else that I saw it with also noticed it too, so
How about the external stuff? The first of all, I don't know if I can't imagine that they would have used a CG plane. I mean, they could have, I suppose, but it's
like overkill. I'm thinking it was, but
really,
yeah, and it was, I think.
Yeah, I mean, okay. it was good. I mean, I thought it looked. There was a really nice shot where the sun kind of came around the side of it.
Yeah.
And illuminated. I thought that was a really nice, just a nice looking shot.
If it was a CG plane, then I was happy with pretty much every shot it was in, with the exception of the first shot where they're leaving the airport in Hawaii. There, for some reason, this, I don't know if it's the staging or the timing of that shot, but the motion in the frame of the plane felt completely unreal to me. And then there was a little bit of funkiness when the plane does the thing where it almost, you know, hits the ocean.
Right.
And maybe it was just the ridiculous, you know, setup that kind of threw me, but there was something not quite right in that shot as well.
Yeah, I couldn't get past the, you know, they did the typical showing the altitude countdown. It's like, you know, 900 feet, 800 feet, 700 feet, and you, of course, get a mental timing for where this is going to go, and then they cut away to stop showing that. And you can't help but just keep counting down, and they must have been about 300, 400 feet underwater before they pulled up based on the timing.
Yeah,
yeah. Those crazy editors.
Yeah, but then there was the effect shot of the plane kind of skimming the water, yeah, and going back up, and that looked pretty good too. It was a quick shot, but
we would always criticize editors because editors are the mime artists to VFX clowns, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, the editor is the retiming stuff is also something that sometimes ends up getting blamed on the editors too, because at some point, I don't know how long ago it was, I guess it's been a while now, but at some point Avid introduced the ability to do retiming in part of the you know, in their editing software, and there was a whole flock of you know, effects people that were suddenly being asked to retime stuff because, you know, not because an effects supervisor or a director made the decision, but because the editor had the capability of doing it, admittedly at a low quality, but they could just do it inside of the Avid. And of course, then you show, you know, the editor would show that to the director. He's like, yeah, that feels much better. And then it would turn into an effect shot, because then, of course, that gets passed over to the effects facility saying, well, we need you to do this now. And especially, you know, several years ago, that was not a trivial thing to do sometimes.
Oh, yeah, there was a whole stage in commercials that you'd get 31 or 30 and a half second, 30 second commercials. And then the editor would just take that whole thing and on Avid just shrink it to make it 30. And it would just go and sort of randomly drop frames, peppered all the way through every single shot. And you couldn't pick it on the offline, of course. It just made the online and VFX work a nightmare. But hey, you know, I'm sure they complain about us too.
I'm sure. Very good.
And the landing as well at LAX, like that was, I understand, pretty much all digital. And I thought that was really good as well. So I think, I mean, the problem is, you know, it's this whole thing we discussed last week about judging a film and judging its effects and trying to remove the assessment of the effects from the personal like or dislike of the film. Because you'd have to say that, a film like United 93, which I think was double negative, but not World Trade Center, but United 93, mm-hmm, had, I think, appalling matches through the windows of the clouds and just a feeling of what was going on outside the windows. And never felt real, took me out of the film constantly. And the plane work on this film actually was pretty good. And undoubtedly, you know, we've seen a lot of digital planes, and many of them just don't kind of buy it as being real. So they definitely did a very good job in capturing those exterior shots.
Yeah, I think so too.
I agree.
And yeah, there was a lot of stuff in the front cockpit where it's the kind of thing where you always look at the edges of the people because you figure there's a good chance they shot it with some kind of green screen outside there and then comped that background in, and it looked good. I mean, it seemed to be.
What I always hate is that they tend to want to expose for the interior of the aircraft and the exterior outside the window. And, you know, there's like four stops difference, if not more, that's going to be going on there. And you just can't get a realistic comp if you want to see white, blue, white, puffy clouds, etc., correctly exposed outside the window and the interior of a plane also lit up. It's just always going to look fake. So, yeah, I was expecting to find fault with the window stuff, and I didn't find any.
So I guess our conclusion then is that the movie didn't deserve the effects it got.
Exactly. Yeah, there you go. I had one question for you guys about duration. This film had a long post period. I mean, they had 5 months, I think it was, and then they got even more. I don't know the exact numbers, but it was they got a lot of time. I think they actually finished the film back at the end of 2005, so at least that was probably the first cut. So this is a film that did have a lot of time, and as a consequence, they went back and put a lot of effects back in, as I said earlier. I'm wondering, is that really rare? I mean, do you know many films that are getting, and what would you say would be the average duration for films in post with VFX that aren't, you know, Lord of the Rings?
Well, I wouldn't say that the post for Lord of the Rings was terribly long, but I'm feeling that we seem to be settling now on between like 6 and 8 months, right? That seems to be the time between turnover of plates and an actual expectation of shots to be handed over, you know, for the editors to do their final cuts and turn it over.
I was going to say 40 weeks.
You were going to say what?
I was going to say 40 weeks, which I guess is close to that.
Yeah. Yeah, that seems to be typical now, and I've heard of schedules that are more rushed than that, and I've heard of some recent high-profile big projects that are going over it, but I think that seems to be the expectation these days.
I do have to say it's, you know, far more rare to hear that, oh, we've got a lot of time to do post on this than to hear, you know, oh, crap, we've got to turn all this around in some unreasonable amount of time.
I guess Snakes on the Plane was fortunate in that, you know, since the expectations were low from early on, right? And everybody knew that they were going back to do, like, my understanding is that they wanted Sam Jackson to, you know, use his trademark, you know, mother effing phrase in the film, and so they went back and reshot it, and as you say, Mike, they decided they wanted to put more snakes on the plane, and so it was sort of like an in-joke that, oh yeah, it's back in reshoots, you know, and just take your time, you know, we'll watch it when you get it out here, we're not in any particular rush to see Snakes on a Plane, go ahead and change the poster, do whatever you need to do.
Well, there was actually a point at the film that Samuel L. Jackson was going to walk out because at that point they were going to change the title from Snakes on a Plane to, I'm going to get this wrong, but it was something like, it was like a flight name, outbound kind of name, you know, like,
yeah,
it isn't, but imagine a United 93 outbound, kind of a dumb name that meant nothing. And he was like, no, the reason I signed on to do this film was this name. The reason that this film's going to be good is if it's, you know, it's not trying to be more than it is, and threatened to walk out, and they, you know, They fix it accordingly.
Yeah, good for him.
And yeah, exactly. And he's right, you know, because I mean, Succeed or Fail, it would have definitely failed had they tried to make it a serious, you know, drama across the, you know, across the skies.
Yeah, it would have been completely unmemorable. I agree.
I mean, sure, if you've got Jodie Foster in there and she's looking for a daughter, I'm buying it. But Samuel L. Jackson, I want him with a gun and and everything that Samuel L. Jackson's so good at doing.
Exactly. Good.
That it?
That's it.
I have nothing more. So, well, great. Well, like we said, we're not quite sure what the next one's going to be, but we'll come up with something there. And for anybody that is out at IBC, pop by the Apple booth, say hi. I'll probably be in London for those of you guys that are in London listening, making my usual rounds of facilities out there. And,
can I make a suggestion that we also, I mean, not make a suggestion, but ask if people are interested that they pop to the MacBreak.com site, because that's where the forums is for the VFX show.
Yep, and places to discuss everything we've talked about. If you love the movie, feel free to get on there and post that.
If we got something wrong, tell us.
And good. All right, then. Well, on behalf of Mike and John and our missing Alex, thanks everybody for joining us. And until then, keep it real. Good.
We're out and away.